you up.
Like he did every day. He's a good kid.
Whenever I see him, I get a smile on my face. All right. So,
I'm going to start a minute early because I'm going to let you go a couple minutes early.
I finished the exams. You should have got notification that the exams are viewable. So if you haven't done so, feel free to look. Some of you did well, some of you not so much. But thing to remember, that's only 15% of your final average. So if you did great, don't get cocky. And if you did, you still have plenty of time to rebound. Again, I literally bought a book to give everyone a chance to make a ton of extra credit. But ultimately that's up to you. I'm not going to force you to do extra credit if you're not interested in it. But, ultimately keep in mind, all of the outlines are posted online. I record all the classes. And again, there's extra credit opportunity that's all year long. So, now's the time, if you didn't do so great, to change your direction and get on a better path to success. And those of you who did great, thank you. Repeat, please. Repeat. Right? I almost was going to ask you if you lived in a barn, and you read my mind. All right, the other thing I got to mention, and I've not been good, I forgot to mention to the first class, is don't forget you have a chance to get extra points on the paper for early submission. So I don't remember what I said. It was either 7 or 8 points. But I'll go back and I'll check out the video and I'll confirm whatever I said just to make sure. So if you get your paper in by February, I'll add points to your paper. Yes?
I was about to ask, when is it due?
Yeah, April 20th or 21st. So there's also extra points available for March as well, just not as high as February. All right, so... did the video. I'm going to check the analytics. Hopefully you guys reach the 90% threshold. That way you can get extra points added in, but we'll see. I also factored in on my spreadsheet at home because I finally created one, so you know everybody had exams. I also went and I got the people who did the syllabus acknowledgement and did the first day quiz. And I added the extra points that wrote on the first day quiz. And I decided... You didn't make the 90% threshold for the syllabus acknowledgement, but those people who did it, I just threw 3 points in because you took the time to do it. So
I have a question.
So
like the first day quiz, you can't do that?
No, you weren't here on the first day, were you?
No,
you can't because that was only for the first day. Damn.
But you don't get graded on it though, right?
No, it's only extra credit. Like all extra credit in here, you don't lose points. You only gain points. All right.
So I'll check out the video, and if you get the 90%, I'll factor that in as well. But on the video, I finished up. I get to talk about one of my all-time favorite, and I didn't mean to talk about it for like 40 minutes, but I mean, seriously, the Christmas Truce of 1914, doesn't get better than that. There has never been, to my knowledge, a recorded instant in warfare ever where the soldiers decided... for themselves that they were going to have a truce on a holy day of obligation. That never. I've studied Roman history and Greek history and Asian history. Never read anything about it. But you got to give the Germans credit. It was the Germans who initiated, and good on the English for engaging. Because they got to enjoy a truly memorable day that went down in the books. Fortunately, on the Eastern Front, where we're going to pick up today... not so much, because like I did happen to mention in passing, the Russians at that time observed a different calendar. They were about 20 days different than Europe. So, as a result, for the Russians, Christmas was not on until, on our calendar, January 7th. So there was no chance of it occurring on the Eastern Front. And on the Eastern Front... the battle was as violent as on the Western Front, only different. All right, 1910. British and French military experts began collaborating, because all of the military plans, they were all leaked. There were spies everywhere. So the French and the Russians kind of had an idea of what the Germans were planning. So they would attempt to design a plan that would foil the German ability to basically maximize a frontal assault on France by doing the same thing to Germany. Because both the French and the Russians recognized that this part right here of Germany is Prussia. This is the heartland of the German state. So, the French and Russian plan was pretty straightforward. The French would absorb the brunt of the German blow and prevent Germany's ability to reposition its men to stop the Russian steamroller. So, essentially, Russia would have a free hand to blast into Germany, thereby causing Germany to negotiate. That was the plan. So that was the focus of Plan 17, Joffre's plan. It wasn't necessarily meant to win, but it was to be like a shock absorber. But the problem was Russia and its military. France could mobilize effectively within 2 days. They had enough men under arms, they had enough munitions, they had enough fortifications that they could be at full might fighting strength within 2 days. Russia, it would take up to 16. So there's the difference. You had 2 weeks. Absorb the Schlieffen plan for 2 weeks, then Russia's in. Additionally, Russian plans came with specifics to ensure rapidity, speed. The Russian troops intentionally were given less supplies, because the Russians had to do a lot of walking. Even though they did revitalize their railways pretty much stopped in Poland. So they would have to walk the rest of the way. So the Russian military, brilliant men, decided we're going to give the men less supplies so that way they can march quicker. And when they attack, then they could pick up supplies in Prussia. Good plan. Good plan. The problem is, once things started unfolding, the wheels came off the bus. From the get-go, problems occurred from within the Russian army themselves. The biggest problem were the generals in charge with the thrust into Prussia. Commanding the 1st Russian Army, Paul von Rennenkampf. Yes, he was a Baltic German nobleman who was born in Latvia, which was Russian territory. He was an effective cavalry officer, very effective cavalry officer. So his focus was lightning, quick, 19th century, fluid warfare. The problem was, joining him on the thrust into Prussia was the turtle. Alexander Samsonov would be in charge of the 2nd Army. Samsonov was a Ukrainian-born officer, career military man,
whose focus was on infantry. So they had different perspectives on war itself. To make matters even worse, these two men hated one another. They literally hated one another. Dating all the way back to the Russo-Japanese War, where both were rumored to engage in multiple fist fights when the battles didn't go the way the other wanted to. Each was dependent upon the other. And I can't even say loathed. I mean, they despised one another.
So, when the plan to attack occurred, because of Rennenkopf's focus on cavalry, he managed to penetrate 2 days before the turtle, Samsonov, focusing on infantry, arrived.
So there was a 2-day gap. Now, the attack was expected. But the problem was the Schlieffen plan. Moltke the Younger intentionally put most of the German strength. I mean, there were 7 armies on the Western Front. The plan was to overwhelm France and then shift before Russia could react. But defending Prussia was a 1 single army group, the 8th Army. And both the Russian 1st and the Russian 2nd was larger than the German 8th, significantly, by like 30%. Commanding the 8th Army was General Maximilian von Prittwitz. Prittwitz was, for the most part, a by-the-book commander. But he also expected all of his officers to be by the book. So long story short, he was ordered by von Moltke not to strike. But rather, his job was to basically slow down the Russian invasion. So a couple of shots, tactical retreat. A couple of shots, tactical retreat. Just slow things down to give the Schlieffen plan a chance to unfold. The very first shots fired on the Eastern Front occurred midday, August 17th, at the Battle of Stolypoin. Located right here, just beyond the border of Prussia. They just kind of marched right in and started rolling over everything. Commanding the troops at the front lines was Field Commander Hermann von Francois. Well, unlike Prittwitz, who was a by-the-book guy, Francois was bold. So he completely disobeyed Prittwitz's orders, and he led his 18,000 men against the 100,000 First Army. He struck the right flank. He was absolutely convinced that German training, German equipment, made up for the fact that they were outnumbered significantly. And he pressed the offensive. despite the fact that he was outnumbered overwhelmingly, he inflicted 5,000 casualties, captured 3,000 POWs, before withdrawing rapidly 15 miles backwards to Gumbian. Rennenkampf was stunned, and he ordered his army to stop. So he stops here, but the Second Army is continuing forward, creating a gap. Eventually, Rennenkampf recovers and begins to move forward. The first full-scale battle is the Battle of Gumbinnen. Now, after his success, Francois persuaded Prozwick to actually strike with the entire 8th Army. So, the 2nd Army is down here. Francois says, no, go all in. Everything you got, go at him. Which, of course, if the turtle, or I should say anyone else other than the turtle, was in command of the 2nd, all they would have to do is drive north. They could sever East Prussia and destroy the 8th Army completely. But again, it's the turtle in charge of the 2nd. So, going against Moltke's orders, Prozwitz pitted 150,000 German soldiers against the now reinforced 1st Army, totaling 190,000. Now, initially, the Germans apparently were successful, but the Russians were able to bring up their artillery quickly and open fire, pounding the German lines, forcing them to begin pulling back. Then, being the good commander, cavalry guy, Rennenkampf unleashed his cavalry and essentially would flank the German positions, which caused Prozwitz to freak out completely and calling a full withdrawal all the way out of East Prussia, abandoning the cities and villages to the Russians. Casualties were high. 8,000 casualties on the German side, plus 7,000 prisoners of war were lost. But the Russians, on the other hand, paid a mighty price. 18,000 casualties. But it was abysmal failure. The eastern section of Germany is now completely exposed. It's unguarded. It's unprotected. And all that stands in its way is an army that's on full retreat. Then Moltke did something that would change the direction of the war. The first thing that he did, fire Prozwitz and all of his staff officers. Gone, including Francois. Gone. Because neither could obey orders. He then changed the Schlieffen plan, which we talked about. Why did he have to shift the wing that was supposed to encircle Paris? He took half the strength of the first. So if you recall, when we showed you that adjusted map, the first, instead of sweeping around Paris, was now going directly at it. It had to be closer to the German second, because they didn't have as much manpower. Because half of the 1st Army was shifted to the east. The marching wing was gone. Which ultimately would result in the Western Front becoming a stalemate. Because of the race to the sea. And then even more fateful than all that was
who he picked as replacements?
He would select Field Marshal Paul von Hindenburg and his chief deputy, General Erich Ludendorff, to take control of the Eastern Front. All right. How do I do it? Okay, good. Go back. I wasn't sure where I got. Now I know. Hindenburg already was a legend. He had been in the German army since the days before unification. He had served in the Seven Weeks War, against Austria. He had fought and led men in the Franco-Prussian War. He would, after those wars, he would take the officer's exams, qualifying for officer positions, and he would quickly rise through the ranks. He actually would serve on Field Marshal Schlieffen's general staff. He would teach at the Officer Academy in Berlin and would become a master of topography. Hindenburg was one of the few general officers that realized you gotta know the terrain. And if you know what's there, you can exploit it with sweeping maneuvers. You can use it to your advantage. The high point of his career came one year when he was allowed to war game against the Kaiser. Now, as I'm pretty sure I told you, the Kaiser had Erb's palsy. He had that limp left arm. So as a result, he never got to actually serve in the military, but he liked to play war. When he was a little kid, he didn't have little G.I. Joe guys. He actually had soldiers that he could play with. Real men. With real weapons. Although they fired blanks. But once he became Kaiser, one of his hobbies was actually serving as a field commander for a pretend army, and he would battle against his generals. No general in their right mind would beat the Kaiser. But Hindenburg did so convincingly that he would forever earn the Kaiser's respect. So long story short, he could do no wrong. When Schlieffen retired in 1906, he actually recommended Hindenburg as his replacement, and he only narrowly lost out to Moltke. But then in 1911, after serving the German army for 46 years, achieving the highest rank you can get, field marshal, he decides to retire. He went home to the province of Hanover, where for the first time in his adult life, he actually got to reside in the home of his father. Well, when the war began and the Eastern Front deteriorated, he was called out of retirement by the Kaiser himself. And he would be given full command over the Eastern Front. As far as Ludendorff goes, Ludendorff was assigned to be Hindenburg's chief of staff. Ludendorff was a military tactician. He was the key player in the siege of Liege. Before the war started, when the air of war was in the sky, he actually personally, dressed as a civilian, traveled to Liege and studied the city's defenses. Then he came home and he started wargaming it. How are we going to knock out these towers that all have intersecting lines of fire? And ultimately, it was his idea to use the Krupp and the Skoda guns that would pulverize the towers. He used his eyes, experiential learning, to realize sending men against towers guarded by machine guns and cannon, bad idea. Well, because of the sweeping success of Liege, he was actually awarded the highest medal available, given by the Kaiser himself personally, the Order of Merit.
This would allow him to adorn the Iron Cross
with leaves. Well, instead of going back to the Western Front, when Hindenburg was called out of retirement, it was Moltke who personally ordered Ludendorff to travel the East and serve with Hindenburg. And man, was this a match made in heaven. Match made in heaven. Hindenburg, stable. Authoritative. Iron-nerved. Unflinching. Ludendorff, younger, energetic, imaginative, and even, dare I say, sometimes outright brilliant. But here's the catch. Both had ruthless ambition. And they had egos the size of Big Bertha. So, when they took command of the Eastern Front, it was as much about them as it was the front. All right, questions?
Legend served 46 years. Oh, I didn't know I gave you details. Key player in the Siege of Liege. All right, whatever, we did that. All right, here we go.
So now imagine for me this. The 8th Army has completely collapsed. It's abandoned Prussia. It's retreating. And now they have to deal with two massive armies. In total, put them together, you're talking roughly 340,000 soldiers.
How do you deal with this? Well, with brilliance, with risk, determination. They decided to split the 8th Army until the 1st Army soldiers could arrive. They decide to take the cavalry and leave it standing in the way of Rentenkopf, being the cavalryman. Correctly assessing that Rentenkopf would believe if he sees the cavalry, the infantry can't be too far away. But then they took the bulk of the army and quickly shifted it south in the direction of the unsuspecting Samsonov. The turtle.
Well, Samsonov would be out-turtled by Rentenkopf.
As I told you, Rentenkopf sees the cavalry. He's absolutely convinced if the cavalry's there, the infantry's there. So he orders his advance once again to come to a complete stop.
As a result, I mean, these armies were supposed to be advancing together, but he stops and Samsonov continues to go, creating this gap.
If the two had marched side by side,
they would have ruled over everything. But when one army gets ahead of the other, that provides opportunity.
Oh, I should point out two other things. The Russians did not have trained coding staff. So they had wireless devices to communicate, but they did so just by talking, no code. The messages were clear. So the funny thing is, Hindenburg probably knew more about where the Second Army was because he was sitting there listening to all the reports than Samsonov did. And there was never a single message that went between the first and the second to coordinate. So why was Hindenburg ready to move 150,000 men and not stop one army but go at another? There you go. He knew they were not talking. So now's the time to strike.
Oh, there's the turtle. There's the clear messages.
All right. And this is where Hindenburg would give a master class. One of the most famous German victories of the entire war. The battle at Tannenberg Forest.
Hindenburg, relying upon the communications that he was receiving, knew that the Turtles' forces were stretched out. The front of the Second Army was 65 miles ahead than the rear of the army. They were not bunched together. They were moving at different speeds, not in a unified effort. So, here is, again, you can see it on this map. Here is the Second Army moving in a westerly direction, and here comes Hindenburg. Southerly, hitting the Russians in the middle of their army where everything is all stretched out. And to add to his brilliance, Hindenburg intentionally weakened the center of his lines. So when the Russians realized they were attacking, they turned and tried charging the point where they thought was the weakest, not realizing that the center was the trap. The moment the Russians pursued the middle, he simultaneously unleashes his artillery. Death begins raining down on the advancing Russian second, and he unleashes Ludendorff with the cavalry. And they completely encircle the bulk of the Second Army. In a 4-day battle, the Second Russian Army was virtually destroyed. 70,000 casualties, 92,000 POWs. Plus, they captured 500 Russian artillery pieces, although most of them were French made. And the Germans only suffered 15,000 casualties. Destroyed an entire army. When Samsonov, who was way in the rear, got word of what happened to his army, went into his tent, had a couple of swigs of vodka, and then shot himself in the temple. Because he knew what his fate was. And this victory at Tannenberg, again, it was of mythic proportion. Hindenburg would become the war's first hero. And he would retain that reputation throughout the entire war. And by the way, none of you had me for the World War II class. Even after armistice, when the German army is dismantled, he never goes on trial for war crimes. He's allowed to retire. But then what do the German people do? They elect him president of the Weimar Republic. He is their George Washington. This victory showed his genius, his daring. But let's be fair. I always try being fair. The real truth of the matter is it was less about his brilliance and more about just shit luck. Because had Rentenkopf pursued the cavalry instead of thinking the army was in front of him, had he matched speed with Samsonov, this would have never been possible. But it was only because he put on the brakes that allowed for the gap to open up. So, we'll chalk this up in part to the Germans, but we'll also chalk it up to Russian ineptitude. Questions? There is a nice unit on this battle in your book, textbook. All right, with the second gone, now it's just a matter of shifting back north and taking out the first. By the time he was ready to do so, the reinforcements from the west arrived. So, now having twice as many soldiers as he had, he decides to engage in a similar envelopment. But he would be slightly less successful. The Russian 1st and the German 8th would collide at the Battle of the Marcian Lakes. This was kind of accidental in that Hindenburg was absolutely convinced that Rentenkopf would continue to advance. But when Rentenkopf got word that the Second Army was destroyed, he froze. So Hindenburg was kind of like slowly advancing, trying to figure out where he was. But when the battle did unfold, initially it did appear like the Russians were in the First Army were going to collapse just like the Second Army. But thanks to Rentenkopf's use of the cavalry, when it looked like the Russians were on the verge of collapsing, he managed to unleash the cavalry in the form of a second wave attack, a counterstrike. And as a result, it caused the Germans to pull back. Well, the moment the Germans began to retreat, the Russians decide to retreat as quickly as possible. So the battle at the Marcian Lakes was like one of these. Kind of slapped up each against each other in the force. They both kind of went in the opposite directions. Germans thought about pursuing, but the Russians, once they pulled out of Prussia, managed to establish enough defenses to cause Hindenburg to be hesitant. But this battle was costly. 40,000 German casualties, 70,000 Russian casualties, plus again another 40,000 surrendered. But on September 13th, the last Russian soldier left German territory, and a stalemate would come in. Germany definitely had the advantage. Two unexpected victories, significantly less losses. But Hindenburg had to face the reality. If he dares invade Russia, he's going to stretch his lines thin. So is it worth the risk? Ultimately, he would kind of have the decision made for him. Not because of anything that he did, but because what was going on a little further south. Questions? Because let's not forget, it wasn't just Germany in the east. It was just Germany in the west. But in the east, Germany had an ally. Austria-Hungary. Well, let's just say, by the parallel time, August to September 1914, Austria-Hungary would find itself in a horrible position. A position that they made for themselves. Of course, the irony was, is the whole point of this war, the reason why they declared war on Serbia, why they sent the ultimatum, was to beat the Serbians, to get more territory in the Balkans, and to become stronger. Yeah. Well, when we get to 1918, and we see the Austro-Hungarian government collapse, and the army dissolve, we're going to see it didn't quite work out as planned. But that's spoilers. We're not there yet. Not even close. Oh, I did have that on there. All right. Now, here's the biggest problem. This was their plan, but it was unattainable. It was unattainable because of topography. Even though the Austro-Hungarian Empire shared a sizable border with Serbia, because of the mountains, there was very few areas that the Austrians could actually penetrate Serbia. So to put it another way, pretty much all of their force had to go through a tight, narrow pass. When you put all of your ducks in a row, what can the enemy do?
They can bottleneck you, surround you, and destroy your entire attacking force.
Yep, 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 yep. 100% spot on. Now, the Austrians also had another problem. And that would be the commander-in-chief of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, who I did mention in the video. Field Marshal Franz Conrad von Hotzendorf, or as he's more commonly referred to as, simply Conrad. Conrad was a career military man, but he was a political soldier. He joined, he was promoted, but he had actual very little field experience. He did lead men into minor riots that were very frequent in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, but pretty much they would be used instead of SWAT. So if there was a group of people being rebels in one little city, the army would come in and mow everybody down. But he never in his long career had opportunity to lead men on the battlefield against other men. But he had a sharp mind. He was actually promoted within the military ranks as a scholar. He would become a professor of military tactics at the Viennese Military Academy. And he would engage in extensive writings, which kind of created an aura of fame. But here's the problem. Have you ever met somebody that was wicked smart, but was a freaking moron? You can have Mensa level IQ, but you may not understand what to do if your car doesn't turn on. But if your job is to drive a car and you don't know how to turn on a car, how are you going to get from A to B? So he gets all these promotions because he's writing books, but he doesn't get promotions based on actual accomplishments. So even though he studied at the School of Offense, when the war broke out, he's devising all of these complex plans that sound awesome, but have no basis in reality. So, when he decided to attack Serbia, he first recognized, this is going to be hard. So, he would actually reach out to Mölkky and say, hey, why don't we combine our forces? If we combine our forces, maybe we can hold Russia off, drive them back. But the problem is Mölkky is dealing with the Schlieffen plan. So Mölkky basically tells Conrad, yeah, we're not going to send half of our army to the east because 90% of it's going to the west. So Conrad had to sit back and think, okay, well, I'm not going to be able to fight the Russians. So let's deal with the Serbians. Why? Because of politics. Why did the war begin with? What caused it? What was that fateful event that occurred that started all of the dominoes to fall? June 28th, 1914? Yeah. Right. So we got to do something. We sent the ultimatum to Serbia. We declared war on Serbia. We got to do something with Serbia. So again, all of these wonderful, awesome plans on paper. All based upon how things were going to unfold. So, he would send nearly half of the Austrian troops to the Serbian frontier. 500,000 men. Now, because Austria was larger, because it had more people, he just simply believed the Serbians would basically roll over. Not understanding that the Serbs were hell-bent on not allowing their country to be invaded. Conrad selected General Oskar Poterek to lead the effort.
Man, look at all of these medals. Unfortunately, like Conrad, all of these medals are based on loyalty and service to the crown, not actual field experience. Because the Austrians hadn't fought a war since 1866.
One of the problems about not having wars is it doesn't give your officers a chance to get experience. And if your officers don't have experience, how can they command men on the battlefield?
Oh, and by the way, the Serbians were not content to roll over.
The Serbians were up for this. They were ready to go. In charge of the Serbian military was an old, experienced war dog, Field Marshal Radomir Putnik. Putnik, 67 years old, was a career soldier and had seen a complete, perfect record during Serbia's most recent wars, the Balkan Wars. He was one of the only Serbian officers that had 100% success rate. Every battle he led men into, the Serbians won. So he was ready to go. And even though the Serbian army, only about 450,000 strong, was much smaller than the Austrian total strength, unlike the Austrian soldiers, most of the Serbian soldiers had fought in the two Balkan Wars. They were veteran, experienced soldiers who knew how to fight on the battlefield compared to the Austrian soldiers who were good at parading. Also, before I get on to this point, I thought there was more clicks under the Serbian army, but I didn't give you the full breakdown. They were decently armed. They didn't have a single arsenal of a single gun. I looked it up. They actually had multiple guns, all of which were comparable to the rifles that the other armies were using. In particular, they had Mosin Nagants that they had gotten from Russia. And they had purchased Mauser M1903s, which were kind of like a civilian version of the Gewehr 98. The only difference was it fired a smaller bullet. They also had French-made Grasse M1874s, which in 1874 were innovative. It was one of the first breech-loading rifles that the French had. No more muzzle loaders. But the problem is they fought big, black powdered rounds that when you open up the breech, you only could put one bullet in the box at a time. So you'd get off one big shot, and black powder meant when you fired it, it let off a big puff of smoke. So unlike the smokeless powder that most of the more modern rifles fired, when you fired one of these guns, poof, the enemy knew exactly where you were. Oh, they also had a bunch of Maxim machine guns, and they had a mix of artillery. But most of their machine guns and artillery were actually taken from the Ottoman Empire during the Balkan Wars. So long story short, they had firepower. Not as strong in total strength as the Austrians, but seeing how the Austrians were only sending half of their army, more than a match. And this is why this happened. When, on August 15th, the Austrians would attempt to penetrate Serbia for the first time on the southern frontier, because the Serbians knew exactly where the Austrians were coming from, because there was only one way in, there would be a series of battles where the Austrians would try outmaneuvering the Serbian positions, and it literally was like a pendulum. So, the very first battle, the Battle of Sur, Podorik would attempt to rush into Serbia from Bosnia, figuring they wouldn't anticipate this. But the problem was there was no planning. There was no reconnaissance. There was no understanding of the terrain. It was just, okay guys, we're here, the enemy's there, go get them. There was fierce fighting. But the Serbs managed to drive them back. Ironically, this is the first Allied victory of World War I. Then the second battle, and by the way, you can see, I don't know if you can see the map, but this is the narrow entryway. All of the battles that are fought are within almost eyesight of the city of Belgrade, because this is where they were coming in from. So it was just a matter of the Austrians constantly trying to penetrate to get around the Serbian defenses. Second battle, the Battle of Drina, took place September 6th to October 4th. This was the Austrian counter for the defeat at the Battle of Sur. And they managed to send more of an overwhelming force that would actually drive into Serbia. But
the Serbs retreated to a high mountain.
The mountain of Makov Kamen.
And they trenched in. So in order for the Austrians to get around the mountain, which was supported by artillery, it would be a shit show. Because the Serbs could rain down death on the Austrians. So the only choice the Austrians had was to drive at the mountain head on.
Did you ever study the Battle of Breed's Hill? Although it's commonly referred to as the Battle of the Bunker Hill. What happens when men run uphill and soldiers are shooting down at them?
Not a good combination.
No!
You're getting really tired running up that hill. You're not going to get up that hill if someone's shooting at you.
Yes, exactly.
It's a meat grinder.
So what ended up happening was, in order to keep their men alive, both sides literally dug trenches in. And they entrenched. And they tried breaking the lines with artillery. But wasn't successful. So, they had to get clever. About mid-September, the Serbs unleashed a secret weapon.
Because the lines, even though the Serbian position was up on a mountain, were relatively close, the closest point, they were 100 feet away, the Serbs engaged in a mining operation. They literally dug a hole down to some of the caverns in the mountain and then continued to dig underground.
I got a question.
Yeah.
How was he digging the holes, like the trenches and stuff like that? Like while the war is going on too?
Oh yeah. Do you want to shovel fast? Have some guys shooting bullets at you. Don't believe Hollywood movies. Soldiers miss way more than they actually hit targets. Particularly with these rifles. They're bolt action rifles, so you're engaging in physical movements to chamber the round in, then you have to re-aim, and then you fire. They're firing big bullets that have more gunpowder than modern rifles do. So there's more of a kick. So you fire, and then you have to re-aim and go through it all again.
They hit you, though. You're dropping like a sack of potatoes. You're pretty...
Yeah. So I think I made that point. You know, you got an AR cartridge versus the 8mm rounds that my Mauser fires. I'd be hit by an AR any day of the week, as opposed to one of these. Yep. So, long story short, the Serbians dig a hole, they get down into some of the caves that are at the base of the mountain, they continue to tunnel, they dig up close under the Austrian lines, pack the tunnel with explosives, and detonate it. Right at the point where they're observing the Austrians getting ready to come out of the trenches and charge the hill. They blow a massive hole in the lines that terrified the Austrians. And as a result, the Austrians had to pull back because they didn't know what the hell that was. I mean, again, when the ground blows up underneath you, do you expect that? And I'm not talking a landmine. I'm talking literally. They made a tunnel, man-sized, filled with explosives. First use of a mine in World War I. Third battle, Battle of Kolbara. This battle took place in November, at a point when the Serbs were forced to begin retreating. So you have stalemate, neither side's gaining advantage, but the Serbians begin running out of artillery shells. So they're forced to withdraw their lines. And as they withdraw, the Austrians begin advancing. It was a major push. And here you go. Here was the initial lines. Here's where the Serbs had to retreat to. But what this did was it left the capital of Belgrade undefended. So after the Battle of Kolubara, the Austrians would seize Belgrade. So, by the end of 1914, the first phase of the war against Serbia is complete. And there really was no change in the border. If anything, most of the, I can't call them really wins, but we'll say successes, went to the Serbs. Sure, they lost their capital, but they still had the rest of their country. And they managed to drive the Austrians back and terrify them. Huge moral victory, costly. From August to December, 170,000 casualties on the Serbian side, 215,000 casualties on the Austrian side. So again, it's just a pendulum, back and forth, neither side's winning. Oh, but something really bad happened. They also had a pandemic in the midst of it. Typhus erupted in October-ish, 1914, and it would run rampant in the region of northern Serbia, southern Austro-Hungarian Empire, throughout the entire winter. Now, if you don't know anything about typhus, typhus is a bacterial infection spread by those little blood-sucking fleas, or it could be spread by lice. And when an individual gets bit with these bacteria-infected little buggers, the symptoms, high fever, headaches, rash that burns all around your body. But here's the kick. There's no treatment. There's no cure. The only way to survive is for your body to use its natural defenses and resistance to get against disease and hope it's able to beat it back. We have no accurate records how many Austro-Hungarian citizens or soldiers died in the outbreak. But records do survive on the Serbian side, and they lost about 150,000 civilians. So if I had to guess, the Austrian population was about three times larger. So probably was six figures. But how do you fight a war in the middle of an outbreak with the disease that they have no, at the time had no idea where it was coming from? Because you think all of the soldiers were super hygienic? Hell no. Hell no. Questions? All right. I'm going to set the stage for a little bit, and then we'll call it a class. Well, at the same time things were getting mucky-mucked in the south, to the north, the Austrians were equally ineffective. Again, they had the luxury that they had significant mountains, which made penetrating Hungary difficult. So, while they were able to concentrate their forces here to attack Serbia, they similarly were able to concentrate their forces in this part of Poland, which was occupied by the Russians, of course, this Poland down here, but this region to the north of Hungary called Galicia, because the mountains were pretty high along this section of the border. And then down here you have Romania. Romania is neutral. So they really didn't have to defend at all. So they were able to mobilize the other half of their army in the form of four organized armies. And their plan, well, was not as clear. Now, originally, Conrad had hoped that the Germans would join in and they would attack Poland, attack the Russians directly. But when the invasion of Belgium occurred and the Schlieffen Plan was unleashed, Moltke, on August 3rd, informed Conrad, yeah, this is going to be no joint operation. We're going to knock France out. That's our priority. So, instead of waiting, Conrad decides, since war has been declared, to drive towards Warsaw to take a huge chunk out of Russian Poland. Why Warsaw? Simple. Warsaw was a major railhead. Most of the lines that were built in Russian Europe all traveled to Warsaw. So if you take Warsaw, you now have the ability to use trains to go anywhere you want to go. And Conrad's next target, so Warsaw's here, was over here in Kyiv. Or Kiev. That would give him access to the breadbasket of Ukraine. So, he moved four armies. The plan was have three armies to invade, one army to guard the passes into Galicia. Unfortunately, the Russians met his four armies with four armies of their own. The third, the fourth, and the fifth, and the sixth. Third, fourth, fifth, sixth. There we go. In charge of the Russian forces, and here's the Russian forces right there. Overall command of this area was General Nicholas Ivanov. Ivanov was also an old war horse, but he was regarded as being the expert in the whole Russian army on artillery deployment. He also had a lengthy, successful career. He participated in every single Russian conflict since the Russo-Turkish War of 1877. So he fought down in Bulgaria. He also was in China during the Boxer Rebellion when that broke out. He also was one of the few Russian commanders to achieve victories in the Russo-Japanese War. So because of his success, the Tsar put him in charge of the whole southwestern front. He was up to the task. So this is where I will leave off, because I don't want to go late. You have four of Russia's armies commanded overall by a field commander who had actual military experience going against the other half of that desk jockey's armies, Conrad's armies. How do you think that's going to play out?
Not very well.
But the problem is, just like we can't necessarily say Hindenburg was completely responsible for the destruction of the second, we're going to see that the Russians had a nasty tendency to trip over their own 2 feet. But again, we'll deal with that on Tuesday. So, weekend is here. If you did not do well on the first exam, again, all the grades are posted. Read All Quiet on the Western Front, like I said. Bang out a chapter review. Do like the first two or three chapters. If you submit one of those, I'm not going to grade it for grammar or spelling, anything like that. But I'll add 10 extra credit points in there, which is equal to adding 2 points to every single grade that you got. Just get it to me as soon as possible. All right? Wonderful weekend. We'll see you all on Tuesday.